So can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Good. I never like to have my talk up there when I start, so there's just a minute or two when people have to look at the speaker and see what he looks like. Wouldn't want that to go on for too long. Get disturbing, but anyway, it's good to be here. It's both challenging and daunting to give, have the prospect of a talk at the Perimeter Institute because, one, you have the biggest audience of quantum information people and foundations people that you could find in the world, I think. And it's daunting because you have the biggest audience someone that you can find in the world. So let's see what happens. I'm going to be talking, the title of my talk is GHZ correlations are just a bit non-local. And actually, this talk is based on a talk that I gave at the Snowbird meeting that Marlon Scully organizes in the first week of January. And so the first part of it you'll recognize as something that has to do with that meeting. But I left that first part in so I could be provocative for my talk, and then I'll quit being provocative. I just want to draw everybody, this is another good opportunity to draw everybody's attention to the fact that the American Physical Society has a new topical group on quantum information concepts and computation, and, the newly elected executive committee of this group will be having its first meeting next Monday in Baltimore at the March meeting. So if you have ideas about what we could do to encourage quantum information within physics, which is what I see our job is doing, let me know. And if you're not a member, and if you're a physicist, or even if you're not, why don't you join the American Physical Society and join this topical group. Another 50 members, and we're the equivalent of the condensed matter physicists, and that is where division. So we're a major structural level within the American Physical Society, which is pretty remarkable. That's 600 members. All right, so here's the way I'm going to start out with my slightly provocative thing. And I had this quote because I was giving this talk at a 60th birthday celebration, 65th birthday celebration for Ray Chow, who's a physicist at Berkeley. And so I quoted this from a paper that Ray wrote with John Garrison about 6 years ago. And you can see what it's about. He says, we consider the consequences of the observed violation of Bell's inequalities. Two common responses are, one, the rejection of realism and the retention of locality, and two, the opposite. The rejection of locality and the retention of realism. They don't like response one, and they argue that it's somehow inconsistent because the whole notion of retaining locality assumes that space-time is real, and ultimately space-time is going to be quantized, so that's not going to work out. Here's the way they would summarize that. There's a possibility. There's things in the classical world where we can have both locality and realism. That's the intersection here. And in quantum mechanics, you could either abandon realism and retain locality or vice versa. And then they call abandoning both of them nihilism, which suggests I didn't think much of that. I'm not going to suggest that. Here's just a bigger picture of what they're suggesting. So here's the area where we can model things with local realistic models. We can do that for product quantum states, product states for many quantum systems. Bell inequalities are satisfied. And once we get out of that regime to entangled states, then if you want to retain realism, you're ultimately going to have to go to non-local hidden variable models for those entangled states. Bell inequalities are going to be violated. And what they say is the other alternative is to abandon realism, retain locality. So you continue to assert that there's no influences between spatially separated parts. And without the assumption of realism, you can also get violation of Bell inequalities.
I mean, let me be provocative. Why do you call the second assumption realism as opposed to?
You think that things have realistic properties before you measure
them. Well, I mean, my question is, what does realistic properties mean? Like, how do you define realism?
Things have properties before you measure them. That's going to be enough for me. I'm not a philosopher, so I'm not, you're not going to get me to be more specific than that. But let's say the Bell inequality experiment, it would be the two spin 1/2 particles actually have values for the spin components that you're going to measure before you measure them. And you're just revealing those when you measure them.
I mean, your definition of realism is the hidden variables exist.
That's going to be my definition here because it's all I need.
So it's also interesting that that Bell, when he talks about realism, he talks about the realism of tables and chairs, which you find hard to deny. And he just said he doesn't want to talk about particles with spin or anything like that. So
yeah, so
I think Bell would also, to make that negating realism is a way out, he would also be a bit skeptical.
He would be skeptical of that, but he's going to define realism roughly the way I am. So I'm going to say that's good enough for me, and move on.
I guess realism is subjective, and hidden variables that you know what it means, but is or is not realism?
I think I've said enough on that. I want to put a slightly different slant on things. Why do we assume locality when we derive a Bell inequality? We assume locality, you can get Bell inequalities just by assuming that when you examine one system, you don't disturb other systems, which as far as we know are independent of the system you're examining. So really all that's required to get Bell inequalities is a notion of no disturbance. And we use locality to make that assumption of no disturbance convincing. And ultimately you might use Einstein locality to make that assumption of no disturbance convincing. But the real assumption is that when I examine one system, properties of other systems disconnected from it are unaffected. And I'm going to say that's the real issue here. I'm going to say the real issue is between reductionism and realism. So in the middle here, where we have product states, we can give reductionist descriptions of systems where systems can be taken apart into parts and the parts have properties. The way I like to think about quantum mechanics is I'm going to retain reductionism, that is, things are made from parts, there's no influence between non-interacting parts, and hence I'll get a violation of Bell inequalities for entangled states. And if you abandon that, you're left with this other point of view where really the world is a gigantic whole and every part is intertwined with every other part. So, the reason I did this at Ray's fest trip was just to poke him substantially and say, you know, you're not really telling us about locality, you're telling us about something substantially more fundamental than locality. And in the end, this is the way I'd like to look at this. And I heard the same thing from Jeff Boob yesterday, although he can probably disagree with me. For me, this is quantum mechanics. Things are made of parts. The parts are identified by the attributes we can manipulate and measure. And there's no influence that passes between non-interacting parts. On the other hand, the attributes do not have realistic values. And in that point of view, you're kind of pushed to the idea that quantum states are subjective, which is my own point of view. Let me just finish and then I'll. I'd say that's quantum mechanics. This down here is nice stories underneath quantum mechanics, you can put those stories underneath quantum mechanics if you want to, but I think it's completely unnecessary. Quantum mechanics is an intrinsically probabilistic theory. Probabilities are subjective, and they are a guide for behavior in the sense that they tell us what our betting odds should be, and I think that's sufficient. Now, I notice now that I'm giving the wrong version of this talk. I sat there in my office just after I finished talking with Ray LaFlamme and got rid of all this soothing stuff because that would just piss people off. But I see now I'm giving the wrong version of the talk, so that's still in there. All right. I didn't want to annoy people at Ray's fest trip, but I was going to get rid of that here. Not to annoy people. Yeah, there was a question.
Yeah, just how do you understand no influences between non-interacting parts? That looks kind of like a tautology.
Yeah, and that's a hard one. And I realize actually the entire thing is in some sense suffers from precisely that point. But I'm going to assume when I make a measurement that the only thing that changes about something distant is my description, that's going to be the subjective quantum state's point of view, and not anything that's actually happening there. And if you want to ask, what's my ontology? Because that's where all of us who pursue the Bayesian view of quantum mechanics run into trouble, people say, what's your ontology? My ontology is going to be these attributes, which are defined by the attributes don't have real properties, but how we recognize the system is by what attributes it has that we can think about controlling and measuring. And so I think those attributes, in particular the Hamiltonian systems, are real things. But I'm through with my provocative stuff now. If you have questions, now's the time to ask them, and I'll get on to something that's just a little bit different.
Is there a conflict between your notion of reductionism and a relation view where, so if you just have a bunch of particles, none of them have position, but they have relation, they have relative position?
Yeah, I would say they probably wouldn't have any problem with that. So that would be my immediate reaction. And I have to say that my immediate reaction when I'm giving talks is extremely unreliable because I'm actually thinking about giving my talk. Sorry. But that's my immediate reaction. So I call these things stories that we put underneath quantum mechanics. But I think those stories are incredibly useful. I mean, the entire story of giving local and non-local hidden variable models can be very useful. So the rest of my talk is really about such a story. And the story is framed in such a way that it's clear I don't really believe it. But nonetheless, I think we can learn a lot from such a story, in particular about how non-local, how non-local some realistic description underneath quantum mechanics would have to be. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm talking about a different story, one that comes from quantum information science, about how non-local quantum mechanics has to be. So here's the old story, the one that Bell inequalities are based on. We can give a local realistic description for product states. And if we want to give a realistic description for entangled states, that's going to have to be a non-local description. Quantum information kind of teaches us a different point of view. The important question in quantum information is often not whether a description is local, but whether it's sufficient or not. So here would be a potential story you might want to tell, that product states can be given efficient realistic description, efficient meaning efficient as systems get bigger and bigger, whereas globally entangled states can be given a realistic description, but it's only an inefficient description. In essence, you have to incorporate the entire wave function in your description somehow or another, so that's inherently an inefficient description. So that would be a nice story, but it turns out to be wrong. And the fact that it's wrong is why quantum information prompts us to ask a different set of questions. So actually, the cut between local realistic descriptions and non-local descriptions of quantum states is different from the cut between efficient and inefficient descriptions. There are globally entangled states for which we can give an efficient realistic description, and that means an efficient description of creating those states and an appropriate set of measurements on them, and that's the states I'll be talking about. And so for those states, is that when we can give an efficient realistic description of that kind of global entanglement, is that entanglement somehow different from other entanglement? And that's really what my talk is about. So I'm going to be asking the question, how non-local is the realistic description of these states for which we can't give a local description, but we can give an efficient non-local description.
So can you clarify exactly what you mean by efficiency in this context?
I'd kind of prefer not to clarify that, but
okay, well.
So why don't you ask me that after I've talked about the actual example I'm considering, and then if you want me to answer it, maybe after the next few transparencies, just remind me and I'll answer it. So the problem is, of course, we can't talk about efficiency by just looking at examples that don't scale. We have to look at how things scale as systems get bigger and bigger. And so I need to introduce something about that before I can really answer that question. So the first thing I'm going to talk about, and this is where we can give really precise answers, is let's talk about GHD states, also called CAT states. And Well, think about the quantum circuit that makes the GHZ state. And here's an example of the kind of efficient description, although here you can't really see how it's more efficient than some other description because the system's too small, but you should be able to see how it scales. So instead of actually describing how a state evolves through this circuit, that is, we apply a Hadamard and we mix the first 0 and 1 on the first qubit, then we get a Bell state, and then here we get a Cat state, we keep track of a set of operators, a set of Pauli products, for which the state at each stage is a simultaneous plus 1 eigenstate of, in this case, the 3 Pauli products. So we start over here on the left with just a Z for each qubit. After the first Hadamard, that all that happens is the Z on the first one changes to an X. The first controlled knot changes those 3 generators to look like that, and the last one changes it to look like that.
Excuse me, could you mind answering, being really naive, which way is time going?
Time's going.
Some of us are not experts in the field.
Time's going to in this direction.
Time
is going to the right if you look at it. And this final state over here specified by saying it's a simultaneous eigenstate of these 3 Pauli products. And of course, also, if you're not used to the way people work in this field, we leave out the tensor product symbol. So XXX means X on the first, X on the second, and X on the third. Right? Otherwise, it'd just be X. Because it just gets really to be a nuisance to write all that. All that stuff out. So, of course, these 3 guys generate a group, a subgroup of all the Pauli products consisting of 8 elements. And here's that subgroup. That's called the stabilizer group, or the stabilizer subgroup. These are called the generators, or there are a particular set of generators of the stabilizer group. And, of course, because the cat state is a plus 1 eigenstate of these 3 guys, it's also a plus 1 eigenstate of all of these. So there's kind of 2 lessons here. The first is, for far more ambitious examples that I'll talk about later, we could just keep track of these, the set of stabilizer generators, 1 for each qubit, instead of keeping track of the wave function. And it turns out it's far more efficient to keep track of these guys. There's n of them, each of which has n elements. And in the end, the resources for keeping track of that scale is n squared for n's number of qubits. Of course, you have to be able to update, but that can be done efficiently. And you have to be able to describe measurements, and that's the hardest thing, but that can also be done efficiently with order n squared resources. The second lesson here, of course, is this: these stabilizer generators have within them the entire GHZ-Merman argument for why this is a funny state. Because we can just look at this and see if we measure either, any of these 3 products of Pauli's, the ones that have 2 y's and an x, because there's this minus sign here, all of those yield minus 1. Hence, if we thought that each qubit has a value for x and has a value for y, we could just multiply these 3 things together, and that would tell us that xxx, the product of the x values for each qubit, is equal to minus 1. All right? And so if you believed in local realism, you would say you ought to get minus 1 when you measure XXX. And quantum mechanics, of course, says just the opposite. It says plus 1. And that's because when we multiply these things together, you have to use the Pauli algebra instead of numbers of commute. So there was the first lesson. I hope you can imagine that as we scale this up, and it turns out as long as we only use Hadamards, controlled knots, and 90 degree rotations about the z-axis, we can keep track of the quantum state by just keeping track of a set of stabilizer generators. And that provides us an efficient, realistic description of creating those states, that is the dynamics and the measurements that we make in the end. It turns out it's easy to decide, we restrict ourselves to measurements of Pauli products. And all of those measurements are either certain or they're 50-50. And that's you can decide that efficiently as well. So that's the efficient description, that the resources we need to keep track of the creation of these states and measurements on them of Pauli products is order n squared, the number of qubits. That, however, is a non-local description because these stabilizer generators are really properties of the entire set of qubits. So the question we're asking is, could we model everything that's going on with these states with a local description, a local realistic description? Well, we know that doesn't work. That's what this argument said, a local description won't work. But could we just add in some classical communication and make it work? And the question would then be, if we could do that, and you'll see what kind of classical communication I'm talking about on the next transparency, if we could do that, then we would regard the amount of classical communication as somehow telling us how non-local a hidden variable description of these states is. So let's look at that. We'll look again at the same example. So what we're going to do is we're just going to do what Merman suggested for the GHC state. We're just going to say that the x, y, and z values for each qubit, so here's the first qubit, here's the second one, here's the third, they have values. So a 1, of course, means here that z has the 1 value for this first state. That's obvious. We need to do that. And then we have one other random, a random number that can be either plus 1 or minus 1. And we regard x and y as being correlated, which you can't see that correlation because you can't measure both simultaneously. But the fact that they're correlated will appear later on as something that we can get our hands on. So what do we have to do? We have to evolve this hidden variable table through the Hadamard gate. Well, the Hadamard gate's an easy one. Switches at, x and z and changes the sign of y. So the hidden variables just do this little dance to give this second table. Then through the controlled knot, it's a little harder to figure out what the right rules are, but here's a potential set of rules. Of course, exactly at that stage, we're going to start, something's going to start going wrong because the controlled knot is making some entanglement. The reason I don't look at the Bell state, stop with the Bell state, is because you can't model x, y, and z measurements on the Bell state with a local hidden variable theory. So we need to get on to CAT states. So we do another controlled knot, and here's what the table looks like in the end. And of course, this doesn't get everything right. And what does it fail to get right? It fails to get right all those Pauli products that had a minus sign in front of them, so that when we measure those Pauli products, we're guaranteed to get minus 1. It's all the random Pauli product, all the Pauli products that have a random result, right? It gets all the ones that have a plus 1, right? But it gets the minus ones right, wrong, because there's no way you can multiply these things together and ever get any minus signs, whereas the Pauli algebra will generate some i's and eventually some minus signs for you. But how could we get it right? So here's the ones we get right. We forget about all the ones that have random results because we get them right. All the ones that have certain results, and those are the 7 members of the stabilizer group outside the identity, these we get right, which you can easily check by looking at this table. These 3 with the minus sign we get wrong. So how can we fix it? We can just say that when a measurement is made, party 2, could be called Bob, on the second qubit, tells party 1, that is Alice, whether y is measured on qubit 2, and party 1 flips her result if y is measured on either 1 or 2. So it's easy to see this gets these guys right, because the cases where we flip are the cases where there's an x, y, a y, x, or a y, y. Those we flip the party 1 flips her table entry, therefore changing the product, so it's right. So we need 1 bit of classical communication to get the to get everything right. Of course, you have to worry that making these flips doesn't screw up the things you've already got right, but of course it doesn't, because you don't flip in the case of XX. There has to be a Y measurement. And of course, you change the sign of a lot of the random results, but you don't care because they're random anyway. So this will do it. So this is a way of quantifying how much disturbance you need, that is, how much non-locality you need to make this local hidden variable model work. In fact, you can regard this flipping of the table by table entry by party 1 as just a non-local disturbance that passes from qubit 2 to qubit 1. It flips the hidden variable value of that first qubit's table entry. And so the communication protocol can be regarded as quantifying the required amount of non-locality to make the hidden variable model work. So there's the title, which is the kind of cute thing I like to say. GHC correlations are just a bit non-local, and that's literally true. It's a bit. Students should avoid that kind of humor. Probably I should too, but it's hopeless. Anyway, let's see, what else could we say about this? So we could generalize to more qubits. So if we made an n-qubit cat state, which would be this same kind of superposition of all zeros and all ones, and you get it from this kind of quantum circuit just by adding on more control knots from the first two subsequent qubits. It's easy to show that you can generalize the protocol on the previous slide to get everything right in the following way. Let me not describe that. It's basically the same thing. All the parties from the second to the next to last communicate to the first party whether they measure y or not. And the first party counts up the number of y measurements, including its own. And if that number is either 1 or 2 mod 4, you flip. And if it's 0 or 3, you don't. And of course, the mod 4 is there because the Pauli arithmetic involves i's, and so you get mod 4 arithmetic instead of mod 2 arithmetic. So that's a protocol that involves everybody but the last qubit and the first communicating a bit of information to the first. So that involves n minus 2 bits of communication. And we'll just show you quickly why that's provably minimal. So you can describe the dynamics that created the cat state and the final measurement using this local hidden variable model with this amount of classical communication. So of course you'll notice there that when n is equal to 2, that's where the Bell state, no communication is required. And that's because if you restrict yourself to measurements of Pauli products, you can describe all of them by this hidden variable table. To get the violation of the Bell inequality, you have to measure in some other direction, not along the Cartesian axes.
I spaced out for a second. Did you say that in the n qubit case that n minus two parties have to communicate with one party?
Yeah.
Like a fixed party and
yeah. Well, that's the way this part. This is the way this protocol works. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're considering like parallelized communications. Is that a different model, or is that just this is so optimal?
Here we're allowing any party to communicate to any other party, and well, in the end, this requires nothing more than each party communicating to some other party that it's interacted with in the past. Because, as you can see from this, this protocol required the second party communicating with first. And it's interacted with it in the past. The same thing's true for an n-qubit case. So you only require, in this protocol, communication with parties that, between parties that have interacted. So this particular communication protocol, which is kind of the first one you might think of, turns out to be optimal. And let's just show you why that's true. And to show you why it's true, we need to look at 4-qubit entangled GHC states. For 3-qubit GHC states, we already know that a local hidden variable model won't work. So you're going to require at least one bit of classical communication, and we did it. We did it with one. But let's see what's required for 4, and it'll be easy to see how we generalize the argument to as many as we want. So for 4, we can just generalize the stabilizer generators. Here's the whole stabilizer subgroup with all of its. So these are all of the Pauli products for which results are certain when you make a measurement on the 4-qubit cat state. And of course, it's going to be the ones with minus signs that we have to worry about. And there's 6 of those. So let's see what happens. Let's assume that you could make the hidden variable table for whatever hidden variable table you had for this 4-qubit cat state work with one bit of communication. And let's assume, since all the qubits are equivalent at a CAT state, let's assume that bit goes to the first and the second. That can do no better than allowing us to treat the measurements made by the first and second qubits as a single joint measurement. So now we're off and running. We just let S stand for XX on the first two qubits, T stand for XY on the first two qubits. And then you can just look at this table and see that these three things, these three products for all four qubits are minus one. And then you multiply those together and you find that SXX is equal to minus one. Well, SXX is all X's and that has the value of plus one. So this is just a simple generalization of the argument used for GHC states. And it says with one bit of communication, you can't do the job for the four qubit CAT state. So that tells you you need at least two, and we showed you can do it with two. So that's optimal. And it's real easy to generalize this to more qubits. And you find, in fact, the protocol that we discussed is optimal. All right. So now I want to put this in a more general setting. Because we've only talked about CAT states up until now. And now I want to consider the entire class of states that can be created by what are called Clifford circuits. So the rule for Clifford circuits is that we have n qubits. They're in an initial product state from z bases. It might as well be all zeros. The gates we allow are the Pauli operators, that is 180 degree rotations about the Cartesian axes. The Hadamard gate, which is 180 degrees about an axis between x and z. The S gate, which is 90 degrees about z, and we allow one 2-qubit gate, the C naught. And then when we're finished, the allowed measurements are the products of Pauli operators. So the content of the Gottesman-Knell theorem is that these states have global entanglement, or they can't have global entanglement. They have all the kind of entanglement that you need to show violations of local realism of every sort that's been tested in experiment, except in those Bell inequality experiments that measure at 45 degrees. And yet you can give an efficient but non-local realistic description of creating these states and making measurements on them in terms of the stabilizer generators. And that's an order n squared description. So one piece of interest might be that this kind of global entanglement, as long as you restrict the measurements in the Pauli group, can be simulated efficiently, and thus it doesn't provide an exponential speed up for quantum computation. That's clear. If you just do these things, you can simulate what's going on efficiently, classically. The simulation is efficient, but it's not local. And so again, we're going to ask the same question. Could we find a local description and ask to quantify the non-locality in that necessary to make that description work by using a hidden variable model? So that's what we'll do. And we're going to do that for the case of what are called graph states. So here's an example of a graph state. Graph states always look like this. You start with all zeros. You do a Hadamard, that is, you rotate the zero state to a state along the x-axis. And then you do as many what are called controlled phases as you want between pairs of these. And the controlled phase is simply the operation that when the first qubit, when the control is in the one state, it puts a minus sign in front of the other qubit's state. It puts a minus sign in front of the other qubit state, provided that state is 1. So it takes 1, 1 to minus 1, 1, and leaves the other four computational basis states the same. So you can do the same thing we did before and trace these stabilizer generators, initial stabilizer generators, to final stabilizer generators. And final stabilizer generators always look like this. They always look like, if you write it as a little array, x is on the diagonal, and z's and i's on the off diagonal. And the z's occur, let's say, when the first qubit is tied to the second qubit by a controlled phase, as here you get a z. So this is a symmetric array. And that set of stabilizer generators completely characterizes the final state. Of course, there's an easier way to write this than writing out this circuit diagram. In this case, you just draw five qubits with the dots, and you put edges between them if there's a controlled phase between them. And so that's why these are called graph states, because they're in one-one correspondence with these with these graphs.
Question?
Yeah.
If you lose the time information in the graph, does it matter the order you do those?
Yeah, that's a good question. You have to do the Hadamards first, but of course, you just leave them out if you said you started in the x direction. And it doesn't matter what order you do the controlled phases in because they're all diagonal in the same phases, so you don't have to worry about that. So you can regard this quantum circuit as we just look down on this thing from above, and behind it are our initial qubits. You do H's on them, and then these actually are. It's the same symbol for all the controlled phases. And it doesn't matter what order you move them in. So this is what this state looks like if we write it out in some basis. And you can begin to get a little bit of a flavor here why writing things out is a less efficient description than keeping track of the stabilizer generators. So I'm going to restrict myself to graph states because all states produced by Clifford circuits are within a set of local unitaries of graph states. So they're within doing Z gates, Hadamards, and S gates. So I'm just going to say I'm not going to worry about the others. I'm going to restrict myself to graph states and see what we can do. All right, so it might be useful to look at some examples of graph states. Here's the GHZ version of a graph state. And we can see that by looking at the circuit for it. We start with zero, we Hadamard everything, then we do these three controlled phases. And what we do to make it look like a GHZ state is we just move these Hadamards through the targets of these controls. That changes these to controlled knots, and there's some Hadamards at the end. So the only difference between this state and a CAT state is I have these three Hadamards at the end. So that's another reason why when we make up our protocol for this communication protocol for this state, clearly the qubit in the middle is going to be special. And that's going to be the one that was special in the GHZ state. So that's what that state looks like, where the bars simply mean states in the x basis instead of the z basis. Looks just like a CAT state. Here's another example. So-called 2x2 cluster state. So that we get like this. We do all the Hadamards. We do this linked chain of controlled phases. You could write that like this, and then you can easily figure out what it looks like when you write it in the basis. At least if not, you can figure out. There it is. So that state looks like this. It's not a CAT state, and these states have, well, let me just leave it at that. All right. So now back to our example. We'll kind of carry this example along. So some things I say will be in general, and I'll try to say what those are. And other things, to do a specific case, I'll refer to this 5-qubit example. So here I'm reporting on some recent work by John, two of my students at UNM, and Stefano Peronio, and after messing around with this paper forever, we finally submitted it to PhysRevue on Monday, which was good. So I can at least say we did it. So here's the stabilizer generators. Let me just remind you that in general, the stabilizer generators look like this. So there's one for each qubit, and it corresponds to putting an X for that qubit and a Z on all the neighbors in the graph. So how would we make up a hidden variable table for this set of realistic values, knowing that all of these guys have value plus one? Well, we just say, we'd interpret these as numbers and just say that has the value plus one. So that says the table entry, the X table entry for qubit J is just the product of the Z table entries for all its neighbors. And then we will assume, so the Z entries will be random. X's will be given by this. So this is a random number. The X's will be given by this. And then we'll assume that to get Y, that X, Y, and Z are correlated in such a way that their product is plus or minus 1. And since it doesn't make a difference which one you assume, I'm always going to assume plus 1. So here's what the table looks like for this state. Again, the Z's are random. The X's have all these products in them involving the Z's for their neighbors, and the Y's have a product for that, the corresponding Z plus all the neighbors. So it's hard to see from this table, but this gets everything right except the minus one elements of the stabilizer group. It's real easy to check that this gets all of the random results right. It's real easy to see, basically from this construction, that we get all the plus one results right. It's only the minus one results where this table can never manage to generate a minus one, and we're going to get all those wrong. Yeah.
The choosing between plus and minus plus y, that's just going to change your communication.
It's going to change my rule, yeah.
Because I noticed in your first example, the minus, one of them was a minus and the other one were all plus.
Oh, David, you really pay attention. Yeah.
No, but I was wondering. Sorry, it's just to make the rule look nicer, that's
all. In that first example where I had a minus initially, that was just to make the table come out in this form in the end. Because Hadamard's screw up this, Hadamard's in essence both screw up this correlation. So if you actually want to simulate what's happening in a circuit, you have to pay attention to that. But I don't want to talk to you about trying to simulate what's happening in a circuit. So and that's why I didn't show you how this thing comes out of some initial table. But you could do it. All right. Let's see. So now let's talk about the communication protocol that we gave in our paper. So remember, we get all the plus ones right, we get all the randoms right, and we only get the cases where the stabilizer generator has a minus in front of it. That is where the Pauli product gives result minus one. Those are the only ones we have to worry about. So we'll need one little definition. Let's take a particular qubit, qubit J. And let n sub j be the number of its neighbors in the graph that measure x or y. So it's real easy to show that if you have a Pauli product, that will have a certain result, either plus one or minus one. That is to say, that Pauli product is in the stabilizer, or its negatives in the stabilizer. Under these circumstances, where that number is 0 mod 2 if qubit j measures I or x, and 1 mod 2 if qubit j measures z or y. So that is to be true for all qubits. All right? And let's see, I've got an example here. Let's put this measurement in. The overall... Oh, so this is an additional fact that we have to have. The overall, so you have a Pauli product, and you want to know what the overall sign is. Is it plus one or minus one? And this is for the case where you have certainty, so this is already true. You calculate the number of x qubits with n equal 2 mod 4, and the number of y qubits with n equal 3 mod 4, and you take minus one to that power. That gives you the overall sign. So here's an example. I plot down a measurement on this graph. I measure x on the top qubit, which I'll call 1, y on the second, I on the third, z on the fourth, and y on the last. And you can just see from this rule that if this thing is in the stabilizer, it's got to be a product of the first, second, and fifth stabilizer generators. And sure enough, you multiply them out, and there's a minus sign. And our rule here says we should attach, this rule can be done per qubit. Says we should attach a minus sign to the first one, a plus to the second one, a plus to the third one, and multiplying those together, we get an overall minus sign. Sure enough, it works. So now we can see how we can make a communication protocol that works. Each qubit tells its neighbors if it measures x or y. That is, it sends a bit. That's let's say 1 if it measured x or y, and 0 if it measured nothing or measured z. And then a qubit flips its table entry if it measures x or y and the number of neighbors measuring x or y is 2 or 3 mod 4. So that takes care of the cases where we had sign flips on the previous transparency. You can, of course, modify that. All you have to get right is the case where x is 2 mod 4 and y is 3 mod 4. So you can have this modified rule, and that's the one we actually discuss in our paper. And we call these sign invariant nearest neighbor communication protocols. Nearest neighbor because a qubit only has to communicate what it measured to Its neighbor's on the graph, so that's nearest neighbor. And it's site invariant because the rule is independent of site. That is, the rule for the protocol is independent of site, or to put it more precisely, two qubits which find themselves in analogous situations will have to make the same spin flip decision, the same sign to flip a sign in their table. So all this seems to work. It's great. Gets everything right. And I'm sure everybody's happy with it. And I could go home now, and everybody would think it was great. But it, actually, there's a serious flaw with this thing. And well, maybe Lee's identified.
I just want you to state or not the conclusion even of the flawed argument, which seems to be that there are two classical bits of communication per edge of the graph.
Yeah, before we get to that, there in this protocol, there are two bits of communication per edge. If we did this for the graph version of the GHZ state, we'd be using roughly twice as much communication as we used in the optimal protocol. And so you will notice that I don't say anything about optimality in the rest of the talk, because we don't know what's optimal.
One each way.
And clearly for GHZ states, we can dispense with one of those bits, the one that goes out from the center to the outer qubits on the outside. We can just dispense with that. It's unnecessary. So we don't know to what extent we can improve this protocol, but let's say why it's wrong before we get too excited about saying what its efficiency is. The problem is that although this, if we plot down a set of measurements on each qubit, this will get the result of a simultaneous, the product of those measurements correct. That is, it will get right the measurement of the Pauli product, which is the product of all of them. It doesn't get sub-measurements right. That is to say, there could be, or doesn't always get them right. It could be within our set of measurements. In this case, we plot down these guys. Well, a sub-measurement of that would be, let's just say we change this y to an I, so we don't make any measurement there. That's a measurement for which our protocol would predict a result, and we might want to get that right too. And it doesn't always get those right. But let me just show you how that works. So the actual example that I had here, here's where we were before. And here's my rule. And the rule says, now, this guy should flip its table entry, and these two guys should not. What if we regarded this guy as a sub-measurement of this one? OK? So now all I've done is change this I here to an X. So I'm now measuring this set of Pauli operators all the way around the ring. And this guy is a sub-measurement in the sense that I just ignore the fact that I've measured x here. So according to this rule, if this is the whole measurement, I do all the communication, this guy should flip its sign. Of course, that won't have any effect here because in the sub-measurement, that qubit isn't participating. But also, the environment of this qubit has changed so that instead of having, let's see, it has one neighbor that measures x here, now it has two. And so now it will flip its sign. And so for this measurement, we'll get the wrong answer. So that's a big problem. We can fix it for this particular case by using that other protocol, the one where x and y didn't do the same thing. Where y, in this case, y doesn't make a change in its spin flip decision. And so everything comes out fine for the submeasurement. So you might think, well, just elaborating, we can get everything to come out right. But in fact, you can't, and that's easy to show. And I'll just show you, that's trivial. Yeah?
The case where you had the other graph would not be, it's not in the same state. It cannot be put in the same state.
In that particular example, the overall measurement, let's go back to that, the overall measurement that I considered over here, that's not in the stabilizer, it has a random result. So you'll get that one right. It doesn't matter what flipping you do. But if you regarded this as a sub-measurement of this one, or to put it differently, you measure these guys, and now you just ask for you measure all of these, and you ask for the correlation between these four. You'll get it wrong. So it will get the overall correlation right, but it won't get subcorrelations right. So you'd like to do better, yeah, but we can show that you're not going to do better with what we call the site invariant protocol. That is a protocol where the rule is the same at all sites. So the two sites that are in the same situation in the graph, that is the graph looks the same to them, and the accompanying measurements along legs of the graph look the same. You're not going to get those, you're not always going to get those right. And here's a simple example that shows that's true. So here's a graph, and we're going to imagine measuring y's on all qubits. This one is not in the stabilizer, as you can easily see, because this y here, along with four others, has two neighbors in the graph that measure x or y. It's got to have an odd number of neighbors to be in the stabilizer, so this one will get a random result. But we could regard this as a sub-measurement of that. That is, we measure that, and we could ask for the correlation between the four qubits on the top and this one on the bottom. This guy isn't a stabilizer, satisfies all the rules. That is, all the y's have an odd number of neighbors that measure x or y. And it's easy to show this one gets result minus one by the same rules that we wrote out before. On the other hand, any site invariant protocol can't introduce a sign flip when this measurement is viewed as a sub-measurement of this one, because these two guys have to make the same sign flipping decision. They're in symmetric positions. And these two guys have to make the same decision. So you can never introduce a net negative sign. So this guy will always be left, this subcorrelation will always be left with the wrong result. So this opens up a host of questions for which we only have partial answers. The main one might be, well, for what graphs can you use site invariant protocols, and how non-local do they have to be? That is, sorry, non-local is the wrong word. How many neighbors do they have to communicate over to get things right? It's easy to show, well, semi-easy to show, that for any two-colorable graph, that is, for any graph where, any bipartite graph, where you can divide the qubits into two parts, and so there's a whole bunch over here and a whole bunch over here, and they're connected by lines, but they're not connected, the two sides aren't connected to themselves. The protocol we introduced works. This works, gets all subcorrelations right. But it clearly doesn't work for this, and so that suggests that maybe you ought to consider non-site invariant protocols. So I'll just show you a non-site invariant protocol that works, yeah.
Is it possible this is an accident of small graphs, because typical large graphs don't have symmetries where you would even be able to ask the question of two guys being in the same relationship?
It's a good question, and the answer is no. That is, we've explored more complicated graphs numerically, and generally speaking, the site invariant protocols don't work. In fact, it's worse. They only work for small graphs. And the minute you get to more complicated, more qubits, they start not working. So let me show you a protocol that works. You can see that I ran out of good ways to explain this because there's no pictures here. But anyway, this is the way. So for any graph, you can do the following. You select a special qubit that knows the adjacency matrix of the graph. That is, it knows all the legs of the graph, all the edges of the graph. Each qubit tells the special qubit if it measures x or y. And then the special qubit does a computation, which can be done efficiently. So it calculates a generating set of sub-measurements with certain results. That is, it calculates a certain set of stabilizer elements, each of which has a representative qubit that participates in none of the other sub-measurements. So let me just say what that is. So you have a measurement. All the parties communicate to the first party if they measured x or y. And then the first guy can easily calculate from the adjacency matrix a set of sub-measurements that generate all of these certain sub-measurements for that particular overall measurement. And then he fools around with that and makes sure that each submeasurement has a, that each submeasurement has at least one qubit that only participates in that submeasurement, all right? And none of the other submeasurements. Then it's easy to show because all these submeasurements are all constructed from just deleting stuff from the overall measurement. They all commute turn by turn. So there isn't any of this messing around with getting i's and minus 1's. Things all just multiply together in the standard commutative way. So since they commute term by term, the overall sign for any submeasurement that's certain is a product of the signs for the participating submeasurements. So then you get it right. The special qubit simply tells each of the representative qubits whether to flip the sign of its table entry. And for any submeasurement, you've got it right. So any submeasurement will be a product of a certain number of these special ones, and you fix them all. And the sign change for that particular submeasurement is the product of the things you fixed. So that works. It's clearly highly non-sign invariant. Probably possible, might be possible to fix it a little bit, but we haven't thought about that. And that's currently the best we can do. And I say that's in preparation. Well, we certainly hope so. And B. Easton is author on it twice, but that's, yeah.
So, I mean, just like generally, you can reproduce any non-local correlations at all. If every site sends their measurement to one site, that one site works out what their output should be, and then sends all the outputs back again.
Yeah, so that's effectively what.
It only seems different from that in that the representative qubit is only, in the second round of communication, is only talking to the.
The ones that
manage to give qubit from each of these submissions.
That's right, yeah.
Is that typically a sort of small number of sites? Otherwise, it doesn't seem much of an advantage.
Well, this is very little different from one qubit keeping track of the entire set of stabilizer generators, just doing what you said. And the chief difference is that he only has to communicate to these special qubits and the submeasurements. As to how what's typical for how many of those there are, if I could answer that question. For small numbers of qubits, well, it's not much. Typically, there may be only one or two. But I don't really know how that scales. All right. So you might say that the kind of global entanglement you get from Clifford circuits doesn't have the power of, doesn't provide the power of quantum computation because it can be simulated efficiently by local hidden variables assisted by an efficient amount of classical communication. So, well, what's the fair way to characterize this? We found the graph state situation to be more complicated than we expected. We kind of got stuck on that. And we certainly haven't proven anything about optimality, which is really what you'd like to show. But the big picture was, the initial big picture was, we would hope to use this classical communication as some kind of measure of entanglement, a so-called entanglement monotone. And that amount of classical communication would be tied to these states, which, although they're very entangled, don't provide any power for quantum computation, provided you restrict stuff to power measurements. So then we would go on and start putting in a little bit of gates, not in the Clifford set, and we try to investigate how the classical communication grew. We already know that at that stage we'll have to put in some rules on what kind of local hidden variable models we have, because in fact you can simulate anything efficiently with classical communication if there are special qubits around that can do a simulation of the entire wave function. So we'd have to make up some sensible rules. And then the goal would be to try to develop an entanglement measure which actually tells you something about the kind of entanglement that you're interested in. But we haven't gotten to that. As I said, we kind of got we kind of got stuck on trying to understand, and we certainly still haven't understood the full set of equivalent states. So let's see, I should probably end, and I always like to end with this cartoon. And of course, the problem is that it's not just dogs. And so I like to think that the wonderful thing about quantum information science is that it brings these questions about, fundamental questions about trying to comprehend quantum mechanics into contact with the real world, where they're actually important for things we can do. And so one would hope that that would provide a perspective that would help us understand really what's strange about, the really strange aspects of quantum mechanics, and try to get to the point where we can say that we comprehend quantum mechanics. Thanks.
Models that you described all had a similar kind of structure, which was this, randomness is shared between different sites. And each site is given a measurement that they have to do or simulate. And there's a round, or maybe one.
There could be several rounds, yeah.
And they all have to give an output, which has to reproduce the quantum correlations. But of course, real qubits are cleverer than this. In the real world, because given the real cluster states, say I can measure qubit A and get an output straight away, and then you measure qubit B a bit later on, and then C, and maybe my measurement of C could even depend on, mm-hmm. my choice of measurement could depend on what output I got from A.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this is very important in measurement-based
computation.
So have you thought at all about trying to develop classical communication models that can actually deal with this sort of adaptation, and does it make much difference?
Well, I think I can answer that question by saying, yeah, we have thought about that. A key thing you'd not like to be able to do is not just model some circuit at a final measurement. You'd like to be able to do what's the analog of collapse in the wave function by making partial measurements of the entire set of qubits. So we thought about that, but we haven't done anything. Let's see, your second question was, do I think that would be, I think that would be a good thing to do.
Yeah, I have a related question, and maybe I missed something, but it looks like, from what you're saying, on the one hand, since cluster states, are you, first maybe I should clarify, are you saying that cluster states are states that can be made with these, you know, restricted Clifford circuits and can therefore be efficiently simulated?
Yeah, cluster states are a particular kind of graph state.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So it seems like kind of a paradox. So on the one hand, you can make these highly entangled cluster states, you know, you can simulate their construction efficiently, and yet once you have them, you can use them to, you can use them to, they're equivalent to an arbitrary quantum circuit, some of which can't be simulated.
Of course, they do break one of the rules here, and the rules where you only made measurements of Pauli products, whereas, in the cluster state model, you have to be able to make measurements, let's say, at 45 degrees between x and y. So that's the way, from this point of view, that they become universal for quantum computation. Whenever you talk about resources for quantum computation, you have to say things about gates, and you have to say things about measurements. And if you leave out either of those, then you can do anything. And it's quite clear how cluster states get at it by making measurements at 45 degrees. Or you could make measurements, but if you only need measurements at 45 degrees between x and y, then the thing's universal.
If you consider n copies of the GXS states, then for sure we can consider data compression. Then we can consider data compression in the cluster. So, in that case, do you know something about the cluster communication cost?
Yeah, that's a good question. That we another thing that we've thought briefly about, but we haven't done anything is, I mean, that really is going to ask the question, could you change the communications costs if you use the example, basically block coding? And I don't know the answer to that question. It seems likely that you could, but I don't know.
So just the point of clarification of what you said towards the end about these things, relation of these things in table monotones. So a table monotone has to be a monotone of the LACC, CCD, classical communication. And of course, if you allow classical communication, you can do everything. So really, when you say a table monotone, you don't mean that, but you mean perhaps a monotone under local operations alone or something like that.
Oh, I should probably just back off and say I'm not quite sure what I'm gonna find in terms of the standard rules for entanglement monotones. The idea is to have some measure of entanglement where the zero is set at these states that provide no power for quantum computation instead of at separable states. That's the basic idea. So I might have to change the rules a bit in defining those.
Any more questions? No? Okay, can we thank you.